say. You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina. And globally at WPVMFM.org.
Well, howdy, buckaroos and buckarettes.
This is WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. Hello and welcome to A Better World on WPVM. My name is McNair Ezard, and I'm your host for today's show. Each week on A Better World, we take an in-depth look at the people and organizations locally, nationally, and internationally who are working to create a world that works for everyone. And we are fortunate to have with us today Abby Maxman. She's the president of Oxfam America. Abby was with us before, I think it was 2017, but she's come back to give us an update on what Oxfam is doing, because certainly the number of crisis points in the world has not decreased. If anything, it's gotten worse. So we appreciate Abby coming on the show. She has over 30 years of experience, having held leadership roles, including Deputy Secretary General of CARE International. Her work has taken her to more than 70 countries and spans critical global challenges from the apartheid era, the HIV/AIDS and Ebola epidemics in sub-Saharan Africa, and chronic food insecurity in Ethiopia. She has been involved in post-genocide relief and recovery efforts in Rwanda and led large-scale humanitarian responses in Haiti and Ethiopia. Her leadership has been instrumental in advancing gender and climate justice, fighting inequality, and driving Oxfam America's ambitious 2030 strategy. Abby Maxman, welcome to A Better World.
Good to be back, McNair. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I really appreciate you coming on the show. I think most people listening to the program today have heard of Oxfam, but I'm wondering if you could give us a bit of history about it, how it got started, how its focus perhaps has shifted over the years.
Yeah, I appreciate the question, because our evolution has been important. But we were founded originally in 1942 by a group of Quakers and social activists and academics in Oxford, England, as the Oxford Committee for Famine Relief in response to the plight of refugees in Greece. And then fast forward a couple decades later here in the United States, we had a similar group of activists and intellectuals, academics, and Quakers and Unitarians that founded Oxfam in America on the backdrop of the crisis and this war in Bangladesh. And both of those things have important points, because they were founded looking at the plight of a humanitarian crisis in the context of war, but also looking at respective governments' roles in those contexts. So here in the United States, when we were founded, there were some key decisions at the time that really influenced who we are and who we've become. Our founders decided that we would not accept U.S. government funding, and instead focusing on building a broad base of grassroots support to remain both independent of government influence, but also an independent voice to influence government and action. And we also had some other key points in our founding about small scale work, about dignified imaging, and making sure we were educating the U.S. public with fact and evidence-based information. A lot of that has held true, but our journey from post-war humanitarian famine relief, those elements have remained, but we also evolved further to look at both the causes and consequences of inequality and poverty.
I would think the early decision not to accept government funding turned out to be the right decision in light of what's happening in the government today.
Absolutely. You know, there has been, people have said they were prescient in their thinking, and it's something we really held on to, because we believe in overseas development assistance. We are big advocates of responsible foreign assistance, and we've always tried to use our voice as an organization that did not accept U.S. government funding to be a good partner to the U.S. government to influence good practice and positive reforms of how foreign assistance works. So what has happened and what has unfolded in the past 6 months has positioned us to use our voice, our experience differently than some of our amazing partners, and both international and national partners, who have been hit hardest and most immediate by the cuts.
Now, before the show, you mentioned that you've been with Oxfam America for 8 years, and I mentioned a bit about your background in the introduction. Could you put your finger on some things maybe in your background that prepared you for the challenges you and Oxfam face in today's world?
Well, I was always an admirer and my partner with Oxfam around the world in my work doing both humanitarian and development policy and practice. But Oxfam also had some specific muscles, let me call them, in terms of our campaigning, policy, advocacy work that looked at some of those underlying causes of poverty and inequality. So my own work, having the operational experience, the strategy experience, looking at organizations in global development and humanitarian response, but also recognizing that some of these struggles are not single issue struggles. They are systems problems that require complex solutions and dealing with complexity to address them. So this notion of causes and consequences, my own career when I started out many years ago, nearly 40 years ago, as a Peace Corps volunteer, starting, you know, on the ground, listening to the stories of people who were living in conditions of poverty and understanding the policy connections to their plight, that poverty and inequality are not, they don't happen by accident. They are a result of human action and inaction, political choices made by governments, by leaders at lots of different levels. Coming to Oxfam and Oxfam America, the role of the U.S. government, certainly our founding principles, set us up to try to partner and influence the U.S. government, really has been a hallmark, I'd say, of how we do our work, of looking at the complex systems, looking for levers of policy actions that the U.S. government can do. And the U.S. has a disproportionate impact, for better and for worse, as we have all witnessed and learned in recent months, but also over decades, in what happens in places and for people who do not have a voice and a choice of what U.S. foreign policy is. So our own role, we take that very seriously, of how we look at the issues here, how they manifest and affect people in other countries, particularly the most marginalized people around the world, and try to obviously use our evidence, our research, our on-the-ground experience to find policy solutions, to bring those to policymakers, private sector actors, others, to try to have the United States be a force for good.
So have certain recent federal governments been easier to work with than others?
Well, that's thing. I'd say certainly since the Trump administration has come in to power, he and the administration really bragged about taking a chainsaw to U.S. humanitarian and development aid, while also insisting that no lives were being lost, that no harm was being done. I'll talk about that more over the course of this conversation. But the actions of the U.S. government have impacted how other governments are showing up. It has forced some retreat of overseas development assistance by other governments who have been responsible supporters of their development assistance, and recognizing the importance of that in global development, global health, global action, and basically our common humanity. So we've seen, unfortunately, this domino effect of the U.S., this administration's actions, and whether it has forced retreats or even shifting of funding, since the U.S. government is no longer a reliable actor in global development, diplomacy, and humanitarian and development action.
I don't quite understand the cause and effect between that. I would have thought that as America drops out of the picture, other countries would have hopefully wanted to pick up the slack, but you're saying that that's not what's happening.
Well, I think other countries would want to, but there's a confluence of factors going on. One is the U.S. investment as the richest country in the world was significant. 42% of the entire international multilateral aid and development system was underpinned by U.S. government funding. 50% of humanitarian funding in many countries, of the direct U.S. aid work, et cetera, on the humanitarian side. So already in a world that was struggling with conflict and climate and obviously the aftermaths of COVID and public health issues and crises, where there was a lot of sliding back on some of the sustainable development goals, progress that had been made, hard-earned progress that had been made. There was already a stretched system. So both the fact that the U.S. government pulled out so abruptly, so chaotically, it was such a huge gap that no governments could fill that gap. Now there's other issues at play that I hear. I don't want to try to project why other governments are fully pulling back. But those that are trying to protect foreign assistance, it's hard to backfill enough to even meet the need of or the gap created by the U.S. government. Now, as you know, the way that the destructive way, the harmful way that the U.S. pulled out its aid created chaos, massive inefficiencies, really what to me feels like criminal amounts of waste by upending things immediately without warning, without cause, without time to even reorganize, was a very costly endeavor in terms of people's lives, livelihoods, and also other governments and governments where development was happening to be able to step up and try to fill those gaps. So I think in a time of global insecurity and kind of this upending of the norms that have underpinned the post-World War II architecture, there's a lot of stock-taking, pausing, and even those governments who are trying to maintain their aid are also looking at some shifting some of what they have invested in aid to other places, including defense. Now, aid has always represented a tiny, tiny percentage of foreign assistance. In the case of the United States, it was less than 1%. 1% of the United States budget. So this notion that it is responsible, that somehow pulling down aid that helps people around the world, and it did a lot more than that, but that being fundamental, is now being pulled down to basically create tax breaks for the ultra wealthy. It's a moment of cruel reverse Robin Hood that I really, really struggle with.
So do you see the level of hunger and poverty increasing because of the slashing of U.S. aid?
Well, I think there's real risks of that, of all the backsliding. Now, before this administration came in, there was a latest report on global hunger that reflected the previous year, and it had showed some slight progress in reducing hunger, but it also warned that over half a billion people could be chronically hungry by 2030, and nearly 60% of them in Africa. Now, I do believe, I've seen firsthand, I was in the Democratic Republic of Congo last month, seeing the harmful impacts of the U.S. government pullout on hunger, on food security, on access to all the things that go into that. To helping people live in dignity and security, really being upended. And so the humanitarian and peace investments, but also development, we anticipate huge backsliding. And to pivot, there's many places in the world we can talk about, but we also know there are terrible policy decisions going on in places like Gaza, where people are famine is knocking on the door in Gaza, but also other conflict crises where food insecurity and has led to famine-like conditions in many places.
And I'd like to refer people to the Oxfam website because there's some good statistics about what is happening in terms of hunger around the world. But one statistic I saw, and this was on the website, the Sudanese American Physicians Association, it said 9 million people die from hunger and hunger-related diseases every year, which equates to almost 25,000 people dying from hunger every day. I mean, those numbers, I've looked at, kind of followed these kind of, tracked these kind of numbers over the last decade or so, and it seems like that number just kind of stays pretty stable. It doesn't decrease very much.
Oh, it's a tough issue of our times. I mean, I know that we have, in the humanitarian and development system, working to save lives, to protect people's livelihoods at times of crisis and times of great need. I think we have seen this confluence of the climate-related crises, the frequency and ferocity of climate-related disasters have really pushed people who might be chronically food insecure to the cusp. And so at a time when investment in, you know, local farmers, smallholder farmers in sub-Saharan Africa, so that they could have farming that can withstand some of these shocks, those have are now being pulled back. So I think we have a confluence of these issues where progress made, but then rollbacks. And we all know that some of the main suite of issues that push people into hunger or worse, famine, are this lack of support for small-scale farmers and even women farmers who will produce a lot of the food, the climate crises, conflict. We know wars affect food security in so many terrible ways, and a global food system, power and influence of large food companies and global trade that creates this export-driven approach to agriculture that really can harm and hurt poor countries that then must even import food. So there's been an upending of the global food system as well that's pushed communities really further into poverty and the inequalities there.
Speaking of poverty, I read a report from the World Bank that there are nearly 700 million people worldwide living in poverty. And something like, according to that report, people are living on less than $2.25 a day. It doesn't seem like to me that we are anywhere near achieving the UN development goal to eradicate extreme poverty by 2030.
No, sadly, that is true. I mean, I would support that worry. At the same time, this is where, as we look back at the past 5 or so years, there were a lot of indicators showing real progress across many of the sustainable development goals. Poverty, hunger, inequality, gender, climate, water. But I think there was a moment, one of the main kind of setback moments where during COVID, I'd say, was a time that seemed to be a shift. Governments, looked obviously internally, but we've now seen this rollback that I think has been supercharged in this administration in particular by pulling out the rug of support so abruptly, so cruelly, without even giving countries warning. So we've witnessed firsthand, I hear stories from you, some from colleagues everywhere around the world of, you know, health facilities being shuttered, aid just stopping. And even worse, most recently, reports that not only was it they'd stopped providing the aid that was already agreed, but some of it was kept long enough in places in transit so its expiry dates, you know, it went beyond the expiry dates. And so aid being incinerated in places that could have provided meals, high energy biscuits, and healthcare support to people who need it. And it's really a tragedy. I'm kind of out of adjectives some days, McNair, to describe what has happened. If you've anyone who has had the terrible experience of being with a child who is starving and knowing that these very low cost, affordable peanut paste,
right,
high protein peanut paste that can save the lives with some clean water and administered in a safe way, turns a kid, a child who is on the verge of starvation, back into a healthy, vibrant child. And to know that that kind of aid is withheld from mothers and children is just beyond one's conscience, I think.
If you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with Abby Maxman, president of Oxfam America. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina.
Oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since, it's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come.
Okay, that's Sam Cooke singing A Change Is Gonna Come. And our guest today on A Better World is Abby Maxman, president of Oxfam America. I wanted to ask you, one of the issues that is constantly in the news and has been for the last couple of years, and it's even gotten worse, and I wanted to talk to you about the situation in Gaza. Can you talk, I know Oxfam is involved there and has been. Can you talk about what the situation is for the citizens of Gaza at this time?
Yeah, McNair, it is just a horrible situation. Our own staff who have been on the ground for the past 22 months, Oxfam, let me go back a bit. Oxfam has been working in the occupied Palestinian territories in Israel for since the 1950s. So we've been there a long time. We have a lot of experience, and our staff, our Palestinian colleagues are doing tremendous work. And we work with a range of local partners, Palestinian and Israeli human rights organizations, and operational partners who are operating in the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and across the occupied territories. Now, our own staff are suffering through the same trauma and crisis of this terrible war, this tragic war, as those people that we're trying to support. Obviously, the horrible, heinous actions and crimes of October 7th remain top of mind. We are calling constantly for the release of hostages and illegally detained prisoners, a ceasefire, and primarily unfettered humanitarian access. Now, what we're seeing and experiencing every day is the opposite. Constant bombardment, suffering that we have been trying to call out and show and inform people about since the beginning of this crisis. But our staff and partners are witnessing scenes that are truly beyond belief. Families are wasting away from hunger, collapsing in the streets, too weak to cry, malnourished children having nowhere to go, and preventable diseases that are spiraling. And we know that the medical system was already under siege. It is all but collapsed. And Israel continues to bomb and force people who are so weakened to keep moving yet again with forced displacement orders to unsafe places to get food. So we are seeing every day signs of starvation taking hold. I think we've gone beyond a watershed moment in the past weeks, seeing 15 deaths or more from malnutrition in 24 hours. Periods. It's just been awful. My own staff and teams, one of my colleagues saying that she felt guilty, and this is somebody who's an aid worker trying to keep her family safe, where she feels guilty when she was able to eat one piece of falafel a day to try to sustain her energy to provide the very constrained support we can provide the communities with partners that we serve. So it has been a tragedy that has gone from bad to worse. It is worse than drip feeding. People are dying, and we really are beyond a point of no return. And what happens right now and in the coming weeks really will have huge long-term impact on whether people in Gaza die or live, and how they're going to live, not only with the trauma and the of living through 20 months of siege and bombardment and war, but the lifelong implications from malnutrition. And what's been happening is little bits of tinkering around the edges with symbolic gestures, really, that people may have seen on TV of, you know, aid airdrops falling from the sky. We know that those are a drop in a notion of need. They are actually quite dangerous, so I can talk about that as well. But they make people think, it's a stunt to make people think that everything's okay when it is not. It is a terrible crisis. And, you know, President Trump has acknowledged that children are starving in Gaza. And this is a reality that Oxfam staff and our colleagues and partners have been desperately warning of for months, and we are seeing it unfold before our eyes, and it's a terrible thing.
So how is Oxfam able to function in conditions where there's like a blockade by the Israeli government or bombings every day? How are you able to do anything?
It's exceptionally difficult. And also, I would say of our teams there, nothing short of heroic what they do. When we know during the ceasefire, we were able to surge and scale up everything, water, sanitation, hygiene, food, access to basic hygiene kits. People need everything. This is a traumatized, bombarded population who I was there about a year and a half, just over a year ago, a year and a half ago. And it's hard to imagine how bad things have gotten. But we're doing what we can with our partners to get little bits out. And I don't mean that as a, you know, the enabling environment is not there. There are over 100 football fields worth of aid that are sitting just on the borders of Gaza that Israel has blocked from being delivered. The World Food Program has said that they alone have enough food to feed all of Gaza for 3 months, but they can't deliver it. Colleagues from another organization just told me this week about hundreds of tons of rice that they had sitting on the border since January that has now passed its expiry date. Millions of meals that could have helped people survive going to waste. So it is terrible, and we know that when the Israeli government allows us, we have the ability, the experience, the expertise to scale up and surge aid to where it's needed. Right now, they have put in place a terrible, highly militarized system that is enforces only the strong to be able to go to 4 distribution sites. We had over 400 as an international community. These are people who are hungry, they're exhausted. It's only the strong can even attempt to go through this very dangerous militarized zone to try to get food. And only people who are extremely desperate and also strong would even attempt to go through this system. So they're creating workarounds that are not appropriate in any single way to do responsible, principled humanitarian action that we as a community know how to do based on decades of hard-earned experience and good practices.
Not to mention, if you're a child and you have no food and you're already suffering from malnutrition, your chances of survival are pretty darn slim.
You know, absolutely. And I'm glad you say that, because even if you think about the airdrops or the system that they've put in place, this highly militarized U.S.-supported system, they're giving out food that we don't have. There's not a lot of transparency about what it is, but we know that it requires water, clean water to cook, fuel to prepare. And in the cases of children who are either severely, acutely malnourished, that is not that you need highly specialized therapeutic treatment and food to help people, help children and people on the verge of starvation recover. So again, this is, I think, just a fig leaf saying there's some semblance of food dripping in. And we also know, McNair, there's 2 million people in Gaza, 2 million. So when they talk about thousands of meals or even 100,000 meals, these are 2 million people who we, in our culture, you know, in any culture, we would say need 3 meals a day, nutritionally balanced. You need to have a safe place to sleep. You need clean water. My colleagues are describing the stench of open sewage for the past, you know, for the entire course of this crisis. We know that waterborne and water wash diseases are rampant, all sorts of things. The hospital's not working. So yes, any little bit of aid helps and matters. We are not against that, but we know how to do the job and do our work. And we know what needs to happen to make it happen. Israel needs to stop the bombardment and allow aid in.
That's Abby Maxman. She's the president of Oxfam America. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org.
Gazing through the window at the world outside, wondering, will Mother Earth survive?
Okay, that's Ozzy Osbourne singing Dreamer from the album Down to Earth. And our guest today on A Better World is Abby Maxman, president of Oxfam America. Abby has been involved in post-genocide relief and recovery efforts in Rwanda and led large-scale humanitarian responses in Haiti and Ethiopia. Her work has taken her to more than 70 countries and spans critical global challenges. You know, Abby, I've been trying to learn lately how the Israeli public thinks about this situation in Gaza. On the one hand, just recently, there were tens of thousands of people in the streets of Tel Aviv protesting the government's plans in Gaza and the starvation of people. Yet I came across a poll that was conducted in March of this year by the Pennsylvania State University that said 82% of Israeli Jews support the forced expulsion of Palestinians from the Gaza Strip, something like 53% of Israeli public think that Israel should not allow humanitarian aid into Gaza. Do you have any clear sense of the public's thoughts about what's going on there, the public in Israel?
Well, we work with our Israeli human rights partners and a number of Israeli and Palestinian partners in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. So I can't speak to those polls. I think a lot has shifted since March. Every day, there's been a lot of changes over certainly policy of the government of Israel and the U.S. positioning with Israel. I think what we are seeing is things are shifting. People are seeing these images of starving children on TV. It's a terrible thing. By the time we see that, there's so much that is preventable. But of course, now there's a lot of change, I think, of what is happening. And I would say public opinion is shifting. Some Israeli human rights organizations are speaking out on the atrocities that are being witnessed and naming what's happening. So I know that even just in the past day or so, there's silent protests against the government's actions and what we're seeing unfolding right now. But I can't speak for the Israeli public. Israeli Jews But I do believe that we are seeing a shift in public consciousness everywhere around the world. And I hope here in the United States, where people are also taking heed and of what is happening and feel like they can use their voice, all of us can use our voice to make a difference. I know here in the U.S., sometimes it's hard to figure out what President Trump wants or really cares about, but we've learned some things. He cares about what individual people think in a moment in time, and that starving children on TV might move him to action. So anyone, I get asked every day, McNair, what can I do? How can we do more? And I would say, you know, obviously donate to organizations like ours, go to our website, because we have a lot of information that help you take action, use your voice. But individual, you know, any listener, your conviction, your refusal to look away, your appeals for people who are fighting to survive, these will break through, because I really believe we are witnessing a groundswell and shift in attention and action. And any listener right now, I'd want to say you have more power than you know to influence this administration. And this administration has the most opportunity to influence the Israeli administration than any others around the world.
I'm glad you said that, because when I look at the Oxfam website, as you said, you have different things that people can get involved in to try and make a difference in Gaza. And one of those is to urge Congress to stop arming Israel. And I hate to be a pessimist, but sometimes I feel like such calls are just falling on deaf ears. So I guess I'm just reiterating, thank you for saying that, because I need to take that to heart as well.
Yeah. Well, thanks for mentioning that, McNair. It was just recently there was a vote on U.S. arms to Israel, and it passed. As you say, it's dispiriting to see that continuing approving more weapons. And it's hugely disappointing given where we are, and it's fueling the atrocities. But we are noticing the political shifts. They are remarkable. This is more the first time when more than half of the Democratic caucus has ever voted against an arms sale or security assistance to Israel. We are seeing shifts around the world. We are seeing shifts here in the U.S. We cannot give up. Just because it's disappointing that's continuing still doesn't mean we can give up. It's time to do more, to, you know, use our voice and our power to keep influencing this administration. I've heard calls from both sides of the aisle about this. Very, very small group, but this is a moment to keep using our voice so that we can do so for those who cannot do so.
Last time you were on the program, and just wanted to shift gears a little bit, we talked about the tremendous hunger problem in South Sudan, Nigeria, Somalia, other countries in that area. In addition to Gaza, what would you say are a few of the most critical hotspots in the world right now in terms of hunger and poverty?
Well, I think, sadly, some of those hotspots are still hotspots, where that confluence of climate and conflict in particular have pushed people. You know, we're seeing, as we were saying earlier, some of the trends going in the wrong direction. In South Sudan, people are hearing about the conflict in Sudan, the war that's raging on. It's horrible. And just looking on across the border in South Sudan, the combination of conflict, climate shocks, and the economic instability, and people who are displaced, you leave everything and you come to nothing, creates a perfect storm of suffering with families without enough access to food. So we see these risks in South Sudan, in Somalia. Those continue. And I know it can feel dispiriting to people, you know, about, you know, why aren't we fixing the problem? We know that humanitarian assistance on its own has never been designed as the fix of poverty and inequality. But together, the work of humanitarian action, principled humanitarian action to save lives, and then investing in people's future, helping them get on their feet and to rebuild is part of how development happens. And we did see progress over decades of improvement until recent years. The Democratic Republic of Congo also is a place. I was just there last month. And this is an example of a place where the hurtful approach of the U.S. government pullout was palpable. I went to the east of the country, and they had just faced double shocks. The fall of Goma, the increase, of conflict early in this calendar year. And then 1 month later, just at a time when communities needed their support, the humanitarian support, and also forcibly displaced, they need things like seeds and tools so that they can resume their own production practices. All of that aid pulled out. The U.S. government funded 70% of the humanitarian work in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo, pulled out overnight, creating chaos. A partner of ours, a local partner who does food security, lost 60% of their funding overnight. So for them, it became dangerous. It was dispiriting. You go to communities where aid was promised. It was already signed agreements, and just stopped. At a time, I was there just a week after President Trump had the ministers of foreign affairs from the DRC and Rwanda in the Oval Office signing a peace agreement. Now, fantastic. We are all for that. I met with that minister of foreign affairs while I was there. We all know that peace will be the pathway for development and self-sufficiency for people. People want peace. Nobody wants to be reliant on aid. But on the one hand, signing a piece of paper in the Oval Office, on the other hand, pulling down aid that would have helped people at their exact time of need is, undermining the prospects that this administration claims they want. So we would love to be celebrating a peace deal that could stick. And you have to invest in people and their development and their dignity and their security to enable that to happen.
So does it reflect a certain level of ignorance on my part to ask, where is the UN in all of this?
No, it does. It's not an ignorance at all. It's part of an ecosystem. Now, the United Nations is funded by member states. So the actions of the U.S. government right now of pulling out funding to organizations includes the United Nations. Now, we all have worked over decades to establish really important fundamental ways of coordinating humanitarian peace development work in countries that are in conflict or in crisis or in need of aid. Right now, I'd say in the past, we're all part of this storm where funding was pulled out and thus World Food Program that provides food to hungry people, the funding went away. So everybody is in, we're all in a similar ecosystem of how we have delivered aid and development and support has really been upended. So it is a tricky time, really, since post-World War II and what has been created over decades of learning and how we can support global development and humanitarian action. But it has forced these kind of, I'd say, the chaotic way that aid was dismantled has forced everybody to have to figure out how to realign how they set themselves up. In our case, as Oxfam, we have seen and experienced, whether I was in the Democratic Republic of Congo and I can our work around the world, the pressures on the funding and the activities and the work we do have are enormous. And we are now forced to make these impossible choices about who gets aid and who doesn't. That can feel at times in some life-saving situations, who lives and who dies.
Mothers go hungry.
That's Abby Maxman. She's our guest today, and she's the president of Oxfam America. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. Okay, that's Elton John singing If There's a God in Heaven, and that's from his album Blue Moves. And our guest today on A Better World is Abby Maxman, president of Oxfam America. Abby, let me ask you about some of Oxfam's other work, and you kind of touched on it at different parts in the interview. I see by the website several topics that you're involved with, such as economic and racial justice, promoting a fairer tax structure, educating, like Bernie Sanders is trying to do, people about what oligarchy means, climate crisis, women's rights, gender justice. Why are these areas important for Oxfam to focus on?
Over the years, we have more than an 80-year history as an organization, and we pride ourselves in being evidence, research, learning-based organization. And we have learned over the decades, up until when we launched our current strategy, where we even revised our mission. We focused on poverty and hunger over the years, those still remain. But when we launched our current strategy, we actually specifically added in inequality, that we fight inequality to end poverty and injustice, because we know that you can't do one without the other. This growing inequality, income inequality, the issues of gender and climate justice are all intertwined. We look at rights and dignity in crisis, the humanitarian implications, and we can find, we know that there's a direct correlation to this issue of growing inequality, policies, fair tax systems, and we've seen over the years this political capture by the ultra wealthy, where decisions are made to give tax breaks to the wealthy while taking away basic social support infrastructure for the poor and most marginalized people in the world. So we are looking at a systems approach to tackling inequality and poverty while also helping people where they are. So this kind of dual approach of cause, addressing the causes and consequences, is fundamental to what we do and how we do our work, and bringing research, evidence, issuing reports to influence policymakers in global policy, but also governments around the world. And for us, the United States government is always an important one, but part of our 75 countries around the world where we work includes work in Global North and Global South governments, where we can influence policy in a coherent way, and fair tax policies. We found that everybody supports, nobody thinks that the ultra wealthy should pay a lesser amount of tax than your ordinary worker. And that funding government to provide its basic services to its people is fundamental to prosperity and development and a more equal world.
So how does Oxfam, how do you measure the impact of your work in the various places where you are involved?
Well, at the country level, we have our country strategies and indicators that we measure our impact in our core focus areas. If it's around economic justice and humanitarian action, we have the country by country analysis. As we aggregate globally, we can count up and show some of our reach and our impact. But measurement of kind of global, how we contribute to the global goals, we have efforts underway to do that. But our measurement is always something we need to keep investing in to make sure we can look at how we go local to global and how we can show and bring the evidence about the impact of our work. But as an organization that looks at the systems that perpetuate poverty and inequality, we do a lot of research produce reports to inform the public and also influence policy. But then on a project and program level, like in our water and sanitation work in Somalia, for example, we're able to measure the impact of you know, the what and the how and the who and the impact on people's lives, having clean water and access to protection and food and how they can develop.
But could you say a bit more? You kind of touched on it earlier in the interview about where Oxfam gets its funds to operate.
Yeah, we get it from a range of from when we were founded and chose not to accept U.S. government funding means we are reaching out and funded by a broad base of supporters, hopefully listeners to the show, and also foundations and other multilateral institutions, the UN. We are supported some of our humanitarian work around the world. So it's a range of other government funding, but mostly supporters who want to support independent action and want to see Oxfam using our voice. And that's a differentiator we bring from some of our peer organizations of not accepting U.S. government funding.
Have you seen an uptick in the amount of funds you've received since the ending of U.S. aid, or the Gaza situation has gotten worse?
You know, we're very grateful for the generosity of our supporters, and they've really stuck by us, and we hope they will continue to do so because we know pressures on our supporters are huge. There's many causes people care about, and with you know, the upending, you know, the volatility inflicted by tariffs and all sorts of things happening by the global economy, you know, make it hard on regular people and everyday all of us to donate and to be generous. But we have seen people being very generous, sticking with us. We are grateful. We hope they'll continue to do so. But the need, the gap created by the U.S. government pullout is so huge that it is, you know, we don't expect to be able to backfill, shall we say, that gap that has been created. Other governments can't even fill that gap, let alone philanthropies, et cetera. Everybody doing their part, giving generously, is incredibly important right now. I'd say more important than ever. And we're hoping that they'll stand by and people will continue to give as much as they can as we all try to do vital life-saving work, development work, and help communities where they are at their time of great need.
With all that's going on in the world, in Gaza, in Africa, the hunger and poverty that's all over the world, do you personally have faith in humanity's ability to solve the hunger and poverty issue?
You know, I'm an optimist. I've been doing this work for nearly 40 years, not because I have some blind belief, but I've seen how it helps people. I've seen the resilience of women and families and communities living through terrible times and really unspeakable tragedy, who are both generous and taking in other people into their families and helping people and surviving and wanting to rebuild and thrive. As I was on my way to the Democratic Republic of Congo recently, last month, the first time I was there, it was still Zaire, and I was working in post-genocide Rwanda, seeing the change in development across the landscape as I was driving through Rwanda to get to the DRC. I know that change is possible. I've seen both in the aggregate, the uptick, the improvements towards making progress towards the sustainable development goals, the UN goals that you referred to. And I know that people at community level and our local to global work can make a real difference. So at a time when I think these terrible rollbacks and the rescissions package that was done recently here in the United States, clawing back already allocated funding, I believe not only do we the responsibility to fight for what we know and believe is right, and in investing in our common humanity in investing in communities that deserve better. My own family were immigrants between World War I and World War II. If I had not been able to come, and my family, my ancestors, able to come, we want to be able to create a better world overall. And I really believe and know it's possible. And I know there are so many people who do not agree with what is happening, with what the Trump administration is doing right now, upending everything from dismantling USAID, destroying long relationships, investing in development and diplomacy and peace and prosperity. I know our supporters believe in that. And so I think we can create a groundswell of hopefully resistance that turns the tide if we don't feel dispirited and can keep doing the work and showing up and raising our voice and using whatever power, resources, and influence we have.
What do you personally get out of all this effort that you put forth with Oxfam and in your years of experience? What do you get out of your work with hunger and poverty issues?
Oh, wow. I feel deeply blessed to lead this incredible organization of, I'd say, the most smart, committed, passionate people mm-hmm. in the world, our partners, the communities we work with. It is so rewarding. It is so fulfilling. Getting up each day, you know, looking at some of the most complex issues of our time and putting research, experience, evidence, and helping people. You know, just one person who has hope, who has access to food or clean water at a time when they need it makes a huge difference. When I was in the Eastern DRC last month, I met with a woman, 24-year-old woman named Francine, incredible woman, but she had just been forcibly displaced from a displaced camp. Her whole life is all she has known is displacement and movement and conflict. And she had come back to a community, her village, that was not deemed safe. It was pillaged. There were people, there were dead neighbors who had been killed in the community. And she wanted, you know, she didn't want to depend on aid, but she wanted to avoid the fate of some other young women who were being forced to, who felt that they had no choice but to sell themselves for sex to be able to feed their families. And she just wanted to start a life and start a small business so that she could sell food and provisions to members in her community and start a life of dignity and security. Meeting people whose aspirations, I mean, these are not realistic, unrealistic aspirations. And I think, I know that people, they survive things that I can't even imagine being able to survive. Getting up each day, wanting to do better for themselves, their families, their communities, I feel a sense of duty, you know, the responsibility given the incredible living in the richest country in the world, having the ability to do good and do the right thing and do things right means so much. And again, I feel it's a very rewarding opportunity I've been afforded.
So for people who might be listening and want to get involved with that Oxfam, is there a way for them to do so?
Yes, please. You can go to oxfamamerica.org. You can see how you can take action, how you can connect with our work. We update that regularly about issues and policies and budget approvals that the United States government is doing, you know, up to the rescissions and what will come when Congress reopens. And donate for those who can. Everything you donate matters. It makes a difference.
Okay, on that note, I want to thank Abby Maxman, president of Oxfam America. Abby, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing about the work that Oxfam does around the world. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, McNair.
You've been listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is McNair Ezard. Thank you for listening, and hopefully we'll see you next time on A Better World. And we're going out today with Jackson Browne singing Far From the Arms of Hunger from the album Time the Conqueror.